From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 21st day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. Dave Dickey, your Director of Agricultural Programming, will be along with all the agricultural news for the day. We'll talk about the ag weather with Jim Angel of the Illinois State Water Survey. And in the second half hour of our program, we call that the Farming World on some of these radio stations and always online at willag.org. A very interesting conversation with Paula Savante. She works with Rabobank Argentina and has some really good insight as to the differences and the similarities between an Illinois or a Midwestern corn and soybean farm and one in Argentina. It's all right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
The way the numbers settled up on a Friday afternoon in Chicago at the CME Group, nearby July soft red at 4.72 for the wheat, up 2.5 cents. September at 4.89 1/4, 2.5 higher, and December at 5.20, up 3 cents. July hard red at 4.95 in Kansas City, up 2.5 cents today. July corn futures 3.69, 7 cents higher. September 3.76 3/4, up 7 1/4. December at 3.85 1/4, 6 3/4 higher. And the March corn at 3.97 1/4, up 6.5 cents. May futures at 4.05 1/2 for next year, up 6.5 cents. July soybeans down 3, 9.41. August at 9.33 1/4, down 1 1/3 pennies. September at 9.15 1/4, down 1 3/4. And the November bean futures at 9.07 1/2, down 0.5 cents. January futures at 9.16, down 1 cent. July bean meal futures 2.75.60, down 60. July soybean oil at 39.96, down 43 for the day. June live cattle futures 91.37 1/2, down 7 1/2. May feeders at 108.75, down a nickel. And the June lean hogs at 81.45, down a buck 20. USDA released its cattle on feed report at the top of the hour just a few minutes ago. It shows on feed as of May 1st at 96%. That's within the trade range, placed at 102. That's also within the range, and marketed in April at 99, all nearly at the average trade guess. So those are the cattle on feed numbers released at 2 o'clock Central Time this afternoon. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. July crude oil futures, $69.78 a barrel, down a buck and a penny for the afternoon. June ethanol at $1.59 2/10, 1 2/10 higher. Natural gas at $4.04, down 6 6/10 of a cent. And the heating oil, or diesel fuel, 7 tenths of a cent lower, to $1.89 4/10. Gold futures at $1,175.70 an ounce, down $12.10 on a settlement for this Friday, and the Dow now just about 14 points higher at 10,082 for the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like as it is prepared by our own Mike Sola. He says tonight in northern and eastern Indiana, cloudy, some showers possible, a few thunderstorms. Elsewhere, clearing and patchy dense fog developing, mainly in northern and central Illinois. Lows will range from 50 in northwestern Illinois to 60 in the eastern part of Indiana. And then tomorrow, patchy morning fog in northern and central Illinois and some lingering cloudiness in Indiana. It'll become mostly sunny. Highs will range from 75 in northern Indiana to 85 in the far south, although cooler conditions will be in downtown Chicago. Showers and thunderstorms will produce locally heavy rainfall into the early morning hours of Saturday before a major change in the weather pattern brings a resurgence in field activity and planting by the middle of next week. Flooding will be limited to the river basins. Temperatures will rocket into the upper 80s and the low 90s and continue to stay well above average for much of the next 2 weeks. We'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. When we get to the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Illinois State climatologist Jim Angel.
This is WILL AM and FM. I'm Tom Rogers. With a severe weather warning, the National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a flash flood warning now for northeastern Champaign and northwestern Vermilion counties until 8 o'clock tonight. That's in addition to existing flash flood warnings for northern Edgar and southern Vermilion counties until 8 o'clock tonight and Clark County until 5:30. A little after 2 o'clock, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated thunderstorms with very heavy rainfall across the warned area. Radar estimates of 2 to 3 inches of rain have fallen over the area. Runoff from the excessive rainfall will cause flash flooding to occur. Some locations that could experience flooding include Rankin. The flooding could affect small creeks and streams, country roads, and farmland along the banks of creeks and streams. Once again, the National Weather Service has issued a flash flood warning for northeastern Champaign County and northwestern Vermilion County until 8 o'clock tonight. And again, flash flood warnings are out for northern Edgar and southern Vermilion counties until 8 o'clock and Clark County until 5:30 tonight. Stay tuned to WILL AM/FM for the latest weather information. I'm Tom Rogers.
Very firm in here. I think the, you know, a lot of the bearishness of an early planting, a good early start to planting, or the growing season has somewhat been priced into the market. You take a look at futures kind of by themselves, and we got pretty much a sideways market going on us. I mean, back on March 31st, after the acres report, December corn futures closed at 376, and today we're at 385. So we're a dime higher than what we were at the end of March.
Now, corn futures had a good day, but it was a good thing they had a good day. Otherwise, it'd been a down week, but not by much. What was in that marketplace that pushed things higher?
Well, China. USDA did confirm some more China business. I think, you know, overall export sales have been much stronger than what anybody had really anticipated. You look at yesterday's export sales numbers, they came in well above trade estimates. So we do have underlining demand for the market. The other thing is that I do know the trade is, you know, trying to pencil in a yield for corn for this coming year, whether or not they want to use last year's number of 165 or crank it up to 170, if that yield would actually slip some, if we would get into some weather adversities throughout the growing season and that national average yield would slip back toward the 160 level, that changes the supply-demand balance sheet radically. To the point that all of a sudden we've tipped the balance sheet more over to the supply tightness side rather than the so-called more than enough corn for now.
I suppose at this point it's kind of important to remind folks that USDA had a fairly good number. Was that, was it 163.5 for their national yield when they came out? And it seems, and that's sort of a first estimate, either it was 165 or 163.5, and I don't remember which of the two it was. It makes some difference, but the important part was that that number was, while below last year's yield, still above the trend line yield.
Sure.
And so you think there's even more than that out there?
Well, we're going to have some more acres than we had last year. Now, the big difference on national average yields, and I think this is where one can kind of get tripped up a little bit. Last year we had a very wet growing season, so that basically gave all of your corn and your lighter soils that usually don't yield the big yield because they dry out, and an average July on moisture, their yields fall back. So if we would begin to talk about more of an average tripe moisture level for the month of July and August, it may be difficult to attain the national average yield that we had last year, because last year all areas had enough moisture and they all had good yields, and that's where you get those big bin buster national average yields. You don't get a big bin buster yield on a average type summer growing weather.
All right, so you've sort of outlined two different ways the marketplace could go. Let's go back to USDA again. They say, what, 320 to 380 is the average cash price. Maybe we're at 360 or something thereabouts on an average at this point. And when you look at the futures for the coming crop year, is there anything that a producer ought to be doing at this time?
Well, I don't think the producers are going to do much selling at these levels. I think at least at this point, not knowing necessarily where their production's at, my guess is they're going to be relatively tight holders. Most of them that I visit with, they want something a little closer to $4. They all kind of like to have $4, whether or not the market offers that. We'll have to kind of see. But I don't think at current day prices you're going to get a bunch of farmers selling, and that also keeps the market generally firm because you just don't have no hedge pressure coming into the corn market at these levels. So the speculative interest in the market, whether it's the index funds or the traditional funds that are following the longer term trend following systems, they're probably in here probing the long side, trying to be in position to take advantage of any kind of seasonal weather scare that would maybe occur here during the next 60 days or so.
Is there any more feeling in the bean market of one direction or the other than in the corn market? For a sideways is fine, but maybe in the bean market it's slightly different or not?
Well, I think corn may be sideways in the bigger picture, but I think it is setting itself up technically for a good rally if the fundamentals would come along. I mean, it would not, just looking at this December corn futures, you kind of got a head and shoulders bottom formation in here. That could spark a rally up into the 420 area. That would get farmers kind of close to their $4 cash bid that they're kind of looking at. And then, of course, if we pop up that high, then we'll have to take a look at the picture and see how that's maybe shifted the overall trend. But at least we're sideways, but I think the market is still in position to at least rally to the upside if something would come along supportive. Now, the soybeans is a little different. We've had a pretty steep decline here over the past few weeks. We basically have lost 94 cents on November beans off of that April 21st high. Now, yesterday's price action has got a nice little tail bottom in it. We did close higher, but we really failed to really solidify that reversal to the upside with today's finishes. But I think the bean market would be more in a retracement mode of this 94-cent decline that we've experienced in November beans. And I think, you know, technically probably what most chart people will be looking at will be a return back to like 929, 930 area on those November beans. Maybe an outside shot at going back to the 950 area on a retracement, on a 62% retracement area.
Dan, thanks so much.
Very well.
Dan Zwicker is with ADM Grain Group. He's out of Decatur, Illinois, joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That happens each and every, well, Thursday afternoon. This is a Friday afternoon, of course. He's filling in for Mike Zuzlo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. Dave Dickey will be here in a moment with a look at today's agricultural news.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In agricultural news, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission says it will review the role of electronic trading platforms to determine if sufficient safeguards are in place to maintain an orderly market after the brief market crash on May 6th. Gary Gensler, chairman of the CFTC, said the rise in algorithmic trading and the events of May 6th necessitate a review to determine if further protections are needed. Gensler said, quote, We intend to carefully review the activities of executing firms that act as gateways into electronic trading platforms. Meanwhile, the Securities and Exchange Commission is looking to craft new rules covering the cancellation of trades to make it fairer and more consistent in the wake of the market plunge earlier this month. Retail investors were affected by the nearly 21,000 trades that were canceled by exchanges because they were deemed erroneous. A top Federal Reserve official says Europe's debt crisis poses a, quote, potentially serious risk to the U.S. economic recovery because it threatens global credit markets and large American banks. Fed Governor Daniel Tarullo said Europe's debt woes, if not contained, could cause financial markets to freeze and spark a global crisis akin to the market meltdown of late 2008. Until last week, Fed officials had been playing down the possible impact to the U.S. from Europe's turmoil. South Korea's trade minister today says that South Korea will not reopen negotiations with the U.S. on their bilateral free trade agreement that has been signed but not approved by either country's legislative branch. One of the objections to the agreement from the U.S. side is the allegation that under the FTA, South Korea would be able to restrict the number of U.S. automobiles it imports. USDA reports show that China purchased more than $10 billion in U.S. farm goods in the first 6 months of the marketing year to become the country's number one agricultural export market. Farm exports during the first half of fiscal 2010 totaled $59 billion. China has shot to prominence as a U.S. farm export market over the past few years. At the start of the decade, it ranked seventh, just behind Taiwan, and buying less than $2 billion of agricultural products a year. USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack says the U.S. has no plans to raise the sugar import quota for a second time this year, following an increase last month that fell well short of demands by the food industry. USDA increased the U.S. sugar import quota on April 23rd by 200,000 short tons for the current marketing year, which ends on September 30th. The food industry had argued an additional 1 million tons was needed. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Mark Report and of Commodity Week. That second program you can hear anytime you'd like on our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. We'll post Commodity Week to willag.org by about 6 o'clock this evening. Our guest will be Chris Hurt at Purdue University. Now, up next, do you think you need to plant some soybeans again? I have some advice from the soybean specialist here on campus about replanting. The weather has been cool and damp in recent weeks, and soybeans in the state of Illinois have not yet popped out of the ground in a satisfactory way. Farmers are worried. University of Illinois soybean specialist Vince Davis says their worry may be coming just a bit too soon.
We haven't received a lot of growing degree units or heat units in the last 2 weeks. And in fact, for all of northern Illinois, north of Springfield, we haven't received greater than 150 heat units yet in the last 2 weeks as of today. And it takes at least 100 heat units and up to 150 heat units to get soybeans up and out of the ground, depending on depth that they were planted. And so it's not uncommon for the soybeans to not be up yet, but I know that some fields are very saturated, and so producers are worried that they could be rotting at this point.
Today was Thursday, May 20th. Davis urges producers to go scout before making any rash decisions. It's hard to believe, but the soybean can survive and produce a pretty good yield with a poor stand as long as it's evenly distributed.
Now, this is where it gets really difficult in situations where they will have partial stands as to how many plants per acre would growers consider the cutoff as to whether they need to destroy the stand they have and start over and or maybe just plant into that stand. In some of the data that I've had previously on seeding rates, I've shared many times and on the show before, I've said 100,000 uniformly spaced plants is the goal to have to maximize yield in a field. But for a replanting situation, really you can bring that number down by quite a bit more. At 50,000 uniformly spaced plants in a field, you can still easily achieve above 90% of your original target yield. And really, until you get down to about 35,000 plants or less is where you would get to be before you would be down in the range where you've lost up to a third of your yield potential.
Again, a stand of at least 50,000 plants per acre, evenly distributed, may provide 90% of the yield potential and be a better economic option than ripping up soybeans as a crop and starting over. Weed control will be the primary goal under such a sparse stand, with a goal of getting the field to canopy as quickly as possible, with little competition from other plants. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you. Learned Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learned Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learned Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. Time now to check in on the cash grain market for the day. On the line with us is Bruce Bostard. He's the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Companies, 10 East Central Illinois and Central Illinois Grain Elevators. Thanks so much for being with us, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
Much rainfall up there?
Wide range. I've heard anywhere from 2/10 to 1.5 inches this afternoon.
Anybody thinking they've got beans in the ground that aren't going to come up? We just heard about that.
Oh, I have not heard as much concern about that here locally. Well, let me back up. A lot of concern, but I'm not sure anybody's ready to pull the trigger on replanting yet. We'll see what next week brings.
Yeah, probably the case. Well, it's going to bring heat, so they'll probably pop up out of the ground, although they may have to go out and take care of the crusting, I suppose, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so tell me about cash grain in your area.
It has been overall a quiet week as things pulled back, except for today. And it's amazing what an 8-cent pop out of the blue on corn will do for you as far as buying some corn.
Oh, did you really buy today?
We bought some old and new. I think it was a chance for some people to get some second chance sales. I've been chasing it down, and it popped back up, so we saw some interest.
Oh, that's chasing it down, and it popped up. That's that's not a good way to make a sale, but I guess it's better than 8 cents lower, isn't it? Indeed. What are your thoughts on whether cash grain and the basis will firm up or not?
As we're losing ground on soybeans on the board prices, we've seen some improvement on basis on old crop. There's still good crush margins out here on soybeans. It's real spotty in a wide variety of bids out there on the processors, but on our nearby bid, we're up 4 cents for the week. So we've seen some improvement there. Corn, we're up a couple cents, a real disparity there, too. The St. Louis market has been hot. Peoria's been quiet and rails up a little.
And your bids for the day are?
We are 352 on nearby corn, 928 on beans.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bruce Bostard is with the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois, joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon. Weather in 2 minutes.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, PepsiCo today announced that it plans to invest an additional $2.5 billion in China over the next 3 years. The newly announced investment is in addition to the $1 billion investment the company announced in 2008. PepsiCo plans to open 10 to 12 new plants in China to manufacture soft drinks, non-carbonated beverages, and snacks, and will install additional production lines in existing facilities. PepsiCo also plans to broaden its portfolio of Chinese designated and developed products as it works to provide more food and beverage choices made with wholesome ingredients that contribute to healthier eating and drinking. PepsiCo also plans to invest in agricultural development. It will open 5 new farms for potatoes and oats, bringing advanced irrigation technology to each. Mexico's National Statistics Institute today says that Mexico's economy is surging out of the global economic crisis, recording growth of 4.3% in the first quarter of the year compared to the same period a year ago. It was the first year-on-year growth in more than a year. AAA projects that U.S. travel over the Memorial Day weekend will jump 5.4% this year as an improved economy from a year ago prompts more Americans to take to the road. AAA says that about 32.1 million travelers will take a trip away from home during the holiday weekend this year, up from 30.5 million travelers a year ago. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason on the phone line with us. Jim Angel, state climatologist at the Illinois State Water Survey, right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. Thanks so much for being with us, Jim, this afternoon. We do appreciate that. I'm not so sure that we're going to appreciate the kind of sticky weather that's on its way here. What can you tell us about it?
That's right. If we've had some very dreary, cold days here, and if you're complaining about the lack of summer days, just hang on, because by Sunday, warm, moist air will be coming in from the Gulf of Mexico, and that means summer-like conditions with highs in the upper 80s and low 90s and the lows in the 60s pretty much through Memorial Day. So we're going to see some real summer weather here, and it's going to be very uncomfortable especially after all this cool wet weather.
Yeah, I mean, we've got saturated soils to some extent, and it'll become kind of steamy. What kind of conditions are we really looking at?
Yeah, I think we're going to see some pretty high humidity levels over the next week or two. The precipitation is expected to be near normal. So, it's kind of be a summer-like scenario where you're going to get a lot of pop-up thunderstorms and very localized rainfall amounts. So we really don't see any organized rainfall, at least out for the next 7 days or so. So maybe by next Saturday we might see something. So it's going to be good news for corn and soybeans in that things will be warmer and it'll dry out a little bit. We just don't want too much of that hot, dry weather.
For Illinois, the Midwest, can you kind of take us through Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday and tell me what those days will look like?
Yeah, if we look at Saturday, it's going to be relatively cool, I think, for here in the Champaign-Urbana area, for example. We're expecting high on Saturday about 79 and low Saturday night about 63. So it'll start to warm up by a little bit on Saturday, but by Sunday, temperatures around the state are going to quickly climb up into the upper 80s, and get down to southern Illinois, they're probably going to be in the low 90s. Then we're going to kind of get stuck in this rut of very warm temperatures during the daytime for Monday, Tuesday, and on out to the end of the week there, with highs in the 80s and 90s. And then the lows at night, probably about the mid-60s, which suggests to me that those dew points are also going to be about the mid-60s. So it's going to be pretty uncomfortable compared to what we've had.
Yesterday, the National Weather Service gave us a little peek at what we might have for the summer months. Did you take a look at it?
Yeah, and actually, I was a little bit surprised. They've actually got Illinois and pretty much much of the western part of the Corn Belt in an increased chance of a below normal temperature. So I was a little surprised by that. I think what's driving that is the fact that our soils are so wet right now in much of the Midwest. And usually when it's wet in the springtime, it tends to hold down the summertime temperatures a little bit. So I think that is what they're keying in on.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us today, Jim.
You're welcome.
Jim Angel is state climatologist located at the Illinois State Water Survey right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to the Closing Mark Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. Stay with us, if you can, for the farming world. That comes up next on many of these radio stations. Otherwise, you can hear it online at willag.org.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Rabobank Senior Food and Agricultural Research Analyst Paula Cervantes. She's in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us, Ms. Cervantes. I do appreciate it. Tell me first about your position, if you could, there in Rabobank, Argentina. What do you do?
Sure. Hello, Todd. Here in Rabobank, we have a research department that has analysts that are based on different countries of the world, wherever Rabobank has a presence in lending to the agricultural or agribusiness sector. So the analysts, we generate information both for external clients and internally for Rabobank about trends that are happening in each country on the different agricultural sectors. Being in Argentina, I follow different sectors, grains and oilseeds, as well as animal protein, dairy, etc.
We'd like to learn a bit more about the agricultural sector in Argentina. We know quite a bit about the agricultural sector here in the United States. Can you tell me how many number of hectares of Argentina farmland have been brought into production over the last 10 years and whether there have been current factors that manage that kind of growth?
Today we have 30 million hectares that are under cultivation. Of these, I would say the last 5 hectares have come into under cultivation in the last 10 years, so it's been sort of a 20% increase in the last 10 years. The biggest increase in area under cultivation actually started in the 90s. That was when the biggest increase in area occurred, but it has continued throughout the current decade as well.
And what was it that propagated that increase? Why did it come about?
I would say the main reason has been technology, new technologies, especially in the case of soybeans, with a combination package of biotechnology plus zero tillage systems of cultivating, and that has allowed the expansion to be, it really picked up when that technology came into play.
And what is the rotation for soya in Argentina? And you grow a great deal of corn too.
Yes, usually you can do a rotation that involves wheat in the winter and then a second crop of soybeans, or you can do only soybeans or only corn. Those are sort of the three things that alternate.
So your rotation is very much like that here in the Midwest of the United States.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. And then do they do just a corn-soybean rotation on some of the hectares?
Yes, that's possible in some of them, yeah.
All right, right. And then you say technology drove the expansion of that last 5 million hectares and that it was mostly the soybean technology. I suppose that was the Roundup Ready or the glyphosate resistance that was driving
exactly.
The increase? And were these were these pasture lands that were converted to farmland, or were they newly cleared properties?
Well, first of all, I would say it's both. Some of them was pasture, some of them was used for livestock, and then it was converted to agriculture, to soybeans, and some of it was just not cleared for any sort of activity, and it was cleared for soybeans, and it also soybeans gained a lot of area from the cereals, from corn and wheat as well.
A
little bit of everything.
Are the new lands very productive compared to what was already in place, that is?
No, of course, the newer areas are the ones that have the lowest yields, the areas that used to be almost marginal or that weren't under production before and now have been turned productive. So clearly it's not the prime land. The prime land was already under cultivation. But that's why there's been sort of two sorts of growth in terms of soybeans. One is area that completely was not under agriculture and has come into agriculture. Those are usually the more marginal areas. But then there's also the growth in soybeans at the expense of other crops. So that could be in excellent land that was already under some other crop and soybeans took over.
I don't know whether you can do this off of the top of your head so that our listeners will understand, but what is the price of farmland in Argentina? And I don't know whether you can convert it to acres and dollars or just to hectares and dollars, and we can make that conversion now or not. But relatively speaking, what does prime farmland sell for?
If you're talking prime farmland, it would be around, obviously, depends on the year, but it would be around $10,000 to $12,000 per hectare.
U.S. dollars?
U.S. dollars, yes.
Right, so that'd be about $5,000 an acre, correct? I think that's correct, or something in that range. But it would be competitive with what prime farmland in the United States might be selling for, maybe slightly less, but fairly competitive with prime farmland in the U.S.
Yeah, those are the values for like the best land, right? Yeah.
Right, so for the best land.
$10,000 to $12,000 per hectare.
And is it generally privately owned, cooperatively owned? How does ownership transpire in Argentina?
No, it's all privately owned.
You've probably gotten a look, I suppose, because you were in the World Bank as well, but and in Rabobank, you've probably gotten a look at the details of land sales all around the globe. When a sale is made in Argentina, is it similar to the way a sale is made in the United States, so that there's a common set of descriptive terms that tell you where that property is? And what is currently on that property and what it can be used for?
I don't know the details.
Does the title look similar to the title of a piece of property in the United States is really the question.
Yes, I would say yes. Yes. Right. I don't know if to the last detail, because I don't know the details in the U.S., but definitely if you compare Argentina with other countries that have a lot of problems in terms of land property and titles, which are not very clear, etc., Argentina has none of that. Property is very clear. Titles are very, you know, everything is neat.
Very, very neat and orderly. So then when property changes hands, what impacts the farmland value? Is it soil quality? Is it location? And sometimes here in the United States, it's always soil quality, but it's also location to, you know, the farmer that might want it. If it's adjacent to a piece of property that they already farm, it's probably more value to them than not. But what are the primary influences in Argentina?
No, yes, I would say the same things apply as in the U.S. Definitely soil quality is one of the main determinants. How many tons you can get out of a hectare, that's one of the main things. But location is also important, not only in terms of whether it's next to your other farm, but also in terms of whether it's near good roads, easy access, etc. In Argentina, the best land, what's called our core growing region, is actually very near the ports, the export ports, the ports out of which the grains eventually go out to sea for export. So that's also very convenient. The new marginal lands are further to the north, and so they're further away also from your final, you know, land destination. So that also makes it's more expensive to bring the crop afterward down to the port.
So is the infrastructure there then in Argentina to move from the field to the export market fairly easily? Are there good paved roads, for instance, from most of the primary growing regions to the export market?
Our main advantage in Argentina is that the growing area is within 300 kilometers of the port. So, yes, it's a short distance, so the cost is cheap, and, you know, the roads are fairly good. Now, again, moving into more marginal areas, if we're going to expand northwise, or if we're going to expand to the production to the north, then infrastructure and the length of the travel time is going to be longer. In the U.S., I know that there are a lot of, for internal transport of grains, there's a lot of waterways that are used. In Argentina, transport within Argentina is all done by truck, which is expensive. So if you move further away, that will increase your transport costs.
The transport by the Illinois and the Mississippi and the Ohio rivers here in the Midwest by waterway, as you said, and a great deal of transfer by local or more local transfer by semi-truck or truck, and then also by railway. And do you have a good railway system in Argentina for freight?
We don't.
You do not?
We don't.
We used to,
but today it's it doesn't have enough frequency. It doesn't have enough. Less than 10% is actually transported by rail.
And are there any indications that those further northern sections might get a railway into them so that transportation would be more convenient and cheaper?
Probably not.
Okay.
No, I mean, it would be great, but no, it's more likely, actually, that they will use waterway. It's the same river that takes the grains out of the country that comes down from Brazil and Paraguay through Argentina. It's called the Paraná River, and that river might be used to transport. We already use it to transport the soybeans from Paraguay into Argentina, so it could also be used to transport production from the north of the country. But right now, it's mostly truck.
Tell me a bit more about the export situation in Argentina. And the one we hear most about here is the activities of the farmers as they join together sometimes to either blockade something that they dislike from the government or not. And how much of a problem does that create for the system, agricultural export system in Argentina?
That's a complicated question. The 2008 was a year when there was a lot of problems in that sense, with farmers sort of almost going on strike, I would say, or stopping all commercialization activities. And that was in protest to a number of policies, which included export taxes. The original proposal for export taxes was that they would, this was at the time of peak commodity prices. And so the proposal there was that the tax would increase with price. So farmers were very upset about that, and that's how that started. Nowadays, we don't currently have, we're not having right now any farmer mobilization or activity, but still there is definitely a big tension between the government and the farming sector. Currently, export taxes for soybeans stand at 35% of the FOB price, so that's a huge tax that eventually gets translated to the price that is paid to the producer. Wheat and corn also have export taxes, and sometimes exports are restricted for these grains because they're important in the domestic consumption basket. So the government sometimes restrains it so that domestic prices remain low. What I would say, bottom line, Argentina is very competitive in terms of producing grains and oilseeds. We are able to still compete internationally even with a 35% tax throughout all this time anyway.
You're listening to The Farming World this afternoon. We're talking with Paula Savante. She's a senior food and agri research analyst for Rabobank, located in Buenos Aires, Argentina. More with her when we return.
It's National Strawberries and Cream Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1901, the first U.S. state motor car legislation was enacted to regulate the speed of motor vehicles. The Connecticut law established a speed limit of 12 miles per hour within city limits and 15 miles per hour outside, which were higher than the 8-mile-per-hour city and 12-mile-per-hour county speeds in the bill as originally presented. Also, the car driver was required to reduce speed upon meeting or passing a horse-drawn vehicle and, if necessary, to stop to avoid frightening the horse. In 1916, daylight savings time was introduced in Britain as a wartime measure to save fuel. The legislation was first considered in 1907, but the change failed for lack of support. Few liked the proposal, which called for adjustment of clocks in 4 weekly 15-minute chunks. When reintroduced in 1916 as a one-hour move, it passed. In 1929, the first automatic electric stock quotation board was put into operation by Sutro and Company of New York City. This was the first major advance in market information since the Edison ticker. The board was able to display the open, high, low, and last prices of each stock listed and automatically shifted the figures as changes were made. It was the first of a network of electronically posted blackboards serving the securities industry, activated by a central transmitting station via telegraph lines. The system eventually reached over 700 brokerage offices from coast to coast. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking with Paula Savante today. She is a senior food and agri-research analyst at Rabobank, located in Argentina. Ms. Savante, when we last talked, we were discussing some of the northern areas and transportation issues that might be involved with production agriculture, whether or not they would have a railway into those areas. You suggest probably not, but that they could move by waterway to the export market. How many producers might there be in Argentina of grains and oil seeds? And you may not have that number. And I guess I would say commercial producers. For instance, here in the state of Illinois, something over 20,000 commercial producers, and that would be dedicated at $100,000 in gross sales or more.
I have no idea how many producers there are, to be honest.
What I'm trying to get at is how many there are, and then how they organize themselves so that they can go on strike. It's a surprising event, it seems, although it happens in many places around the globe. Certainly not here in the United States, but other places around the globe. The French tend to go on strike fairly often. The Argentine producers will go on strike of sorts or blockades. And I was just trying to get an idea of how they come about doing such things.
Well, first, I would answer many things to your question. One of them is they don't do that all the time. It's not a practice that is done all the time. This happened at a very particular time when tension was very high and when they felt that what was being done was extremely unfair. So in a way, there was a sort of reaction where everybody was feeling the same and everybody was equally frustrated. So they looked for a way to show that. Now, additionally, usually farmers are nucleated or are organized between different organizations. In Argentina, there are like four big organizations of farmers. Some are like the smaller farmers, some are maybe larger farmers, but they are grouped into some sort of overarching rural organizations.
Yeah, so the organizations, so all four of the organizations decided this was the right thing to do, and they mobilized their membership, is what it amounted
to.
Yeah,
and it was very surprising because those organizations, in normal times, sometimes they even don't get along because one of them represents the large farmers, one of them represents the smaller farmers. So sometimes their interests are very much against each other. And in this, they were all united in the same sort of complaint.
I see. Is there much of a difference between the grain and oilseed producers and the livestock producers in Argentina? Have they been split on issues? For instance, here in the United States, that certainly has happened as of recent over the development of ethanol, corn-based ethanol.
No, I wouldn't say that's the case in Argentina. I say a lot of the complaints or a lot of the interests are in common, and a lot of farmers do both things. It's not such a clear separation.
Average age of the farmer in the United States is fairly old, in the 60s. How about in Argentina?
I don't have an actual number, but what I can say for sure is that in Argentina, agriculture is a very dynamic sector. It's become extremely dynamic in the last 10, 20 years, and so it's attracted a lot of young people. So I would say it's definitely not a sector of people that are older. It's a sector where a lot of young people are going in. So average age is definitely much lower than it is in the U.S.
Well, let me back that up then with one other question. How is it they make the entrance into farming in Argentina when the cost of entrance would seem to be so very high, like it is here in the United States? I mean, land properties are about the same cost. Obviously, the seed and infrastructure have to be roughly the same. It's a very cost-intensive area to get into. How are they managing to do such?
No, I think the difference is probably goes back to 100 years on how each country was originally formed. I think in Argentina, a lot of people already have the land, and the question is, and I don't think there's such a big separation between the people that live in the city and the people that live in the countryside. I think a lot of the people in the city do own hectares and do either rent it out. 50% of production in Argentina is done on land that is rented. So a lot of people today that maybe have inherited some land and don't want to be a doctor or want to be something else and don't want to take care of actually working the land, they just rent it out. And conversely, you can come into the business by renting land, and by renting, all services here are outsourced, so you don't even need to own a tractor. Basically, you need to be, in a way, what has transformed the sector in the last few years is you can do a lot of things by outsourcing some services and renting land, and you don't even have to own the actual assets.
Oh, I see. Well, that does
clear?
No, that makes it that means you can be an absentee landlord and a manager, if you're a good manager, be inside the business to some extent, but not have to own anything other than the property. And then you could. And so you can have others come in and custom farm your land for you, and that's widely available.
Yeah. In that case, you know, you might need to have some access to financing, but it's not, you don't necessarily need to own the land.
That's Paula Savante with Rabobank Argentina. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.